of you don't know me, I'm Christelle. I'm a campus advisor here at Judd. I'm co-recording today's call, but we do have some other folks from Judd here as well, so we're just going to go around real quick and introduce ourselves before we jump in.
I'll start. My name is Kyle Sebastian. I am the Learning Community Coordinator with Judd Campus. I coordinate webinars, newsletters, help assist with discussion calls like this one, and also manage the online resource library known as the Judd Campus Playbook, in addition to working with schools that are transitioning to the alumni phase of the Judd Campus journey. If you have any questions about calls like this one or upcoming slate of webinars, you can always feel free to send me an email or a message with any of that information.
Hi, everyone. I'm Erica Riva. I'm a senior campus advisor here at Judd.
Hi, I'm Ethan Fields. I'm a Judd Campus advisor.
Hi, I'm Feta. I'm a campus advisor. I started at Judd in October. And I'm a therapist. So right before Judd, I was actually working as a therapist on campus at Columbia University, working in disability services with students who were diagnosed with sight conditions.
Great. So thank you all for being here today. This really came out of a lot of conversations that we were having with a number of schools who were either implementing Let's Talk programs and wanted to learn more from what other campuses were doing, or who were considering that and really had some great questions for us around what starting a program might look like. So today we're kind of starting off our call, hearing from Greg and Jude about what the programs at Cornell and Montclair State look like and what the process was like for starting those programs, any challenges they might have faced, or other sort of general advice they have for schools that might be thinking about or in the beginning stages of their Let's Talk program. So Greg, do you want to start us off?
Sure, I can start off. So I believe Cornell was the first place to have a Let's Talk site or a Let's Talk program. The program was really started, there was some kind of, the staff here wanted to kind of philosophically implement the American Psychological Association's multicultural guidelines that had just come out. This was probably 2002 when those came out, 2001, and this was 2003 when I came here. And there was a lot of staff really wanting to get outside of this idea that students had to come to the counseling center to get help. The idea was that we would kind of go where they were and to transcend some of these, fairly dominant cultural ideas about what getting mental health looked like. So that was some of the groundswell at Cornell, including people like Sharon Meir, we were just talking about earlier, who were instrumental in kind of moving this forward and thinking about how we could get out and meet students where they are. And the philosophy was really not making any assumptions about what a student may want in terms of seeking care, to kind of not make assumptions about how they made meaning of their own suffering, but just to be available to them out there in the world. And we really saw this as kind of a public health strategy as well. So it was implementing the multicultural guidelines as well as taking this broader public health approach and getting outside of the walls of the health service counseling center. And then began to start in communities where there was a lot of support for. One of the first sites was in our African-American living learning environment. Other sites were in the Latino studies program. So there were these kind of key places where there was just a lot of energy out in the community and therapists that really got passionate about it. And it continued to grow. And I think a lot of my role was to help mediate kind of the excitement about this with concerns from counsel's office and thoughts about how to move this forward. But it really started as this kind of grassroots, a lot of staff at the counseling center seeing this as really being important and breaking down some of those walls with the campus community.
Thanks, Greg. Now we'll hear from Jude at Montclair State.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jude Oy. I'm a clinical psychologist working at Montclair State University's Counseling and Psychological Services. I'm also the Suicide Prevention Coordinator here. I'm joined by Dr. Sudha Wadhwani, who's our Coordinator of Outreach and Prevention. She was actually the psychologist who brought Let's Talk to Montclair. So I'm going to let her introduce herself and share some words about our Let's Talk program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Hello, everyone. So I have had the pleasure actually of presenting with the founders of Let's Talk over at Cornell, Sharon Meir, Matt Boone, and Wei Wong for several conferences, and they actually have made a video on the history at Cornell. And so, Greg, it's so nice to kind of also talk with you about it, because I'm in awe of your staff, and you're all like my role models in everything we do. So I bow down to you. But how the National Outreach Conference 12 years ago was the first conference, and I was on a symposium panel with the founders of Let's Talk from Cornell. They were presenting on Let's Talk, and I was presenting on multicultural outreach. And so we kind of were put on the same symposium. And so then it was kind of, you know, a love fest started, and they consulted with us here at their state on starting our Let's Talk program. And we started with one or two sites back 10, 12 years ago. And now we have 9 fully thriving sites. We just got our stats for you, and we've seen 457 students at our Let's Talks in the fall semester. Two of our sites seeing 68 students through the semester. I would say, you know, there's times we have up to 8 students in a 90-minute slot. There's times we might get 2, but we've really worked on really increasing access to support on campus, really destigmatizing reaching out. I do think it means it's kind of a cool thing to do, actually, and there's just not that much stigma about it. I will go to one of our Let's Talk sites, and students will be sitting there waiting. So it's been wonderful, and we're kind of struggling to actually meet the demand. I would say it's about 50-50 at being a feeder to our other Let's Talk services and come on an as-needed basis. And I think, as Greg said, Sharon Meir, who really is a community psychologist at heart, you know, her main principle was to reach people in non-traditional ways rather than having them conform to our more traditional four walls of our counseling center. We actually, one time we presented together, we called our presentation Taking the Couch on the Road, and we had a picture of students carrying a couch across campus.
That's so Sharon.
Yes. And so we really believed in like a true multicultural perspective. And she actually went so far as kind of saying, you know, she really believes in that true cultural competence is meeting people in their traditional worlds, not just restructuring how we do therapy within our offices, that we really do need to get out there and meet them where they are. We see people on average about 15 to 20 minutes. We frame it as it's like office hours with a professor, but with a counselor, and we'll see people one at a time, one-on-one. Sometimes there's a myth out there on campus that it's a group, a let's group, because let's, you know, is let us. So we've had, you know, everywhere we have our Let's Talk logo, we say one-on-one consultation and support. And we have 9 sites. They're strategically placed to reach students who in the literature and in our statistics tend to underutilize our more traditional services. So, for example, in our EOF office, they're chosen for populations we want to reach and also geographical location. We, unfortunately, as a counseling center, are on the periphery of one end of campus and not very accessible. So we really try to have our other locations more centrally located. We do have a few students who are not living in the res hall, aren't necessarily going to go there. But in other buildings where there are dining facilities, where there are advisors, we have 2 sites in the student center, one on the same floor as the dean's. We have one in the library. We have a site in our building that has most of our humanities and social sciences classes. One in our Disability Resource Center, which also has is in the same building as EOF and all of our advisors. We have one in the arts and communications. Oh, yes. And we have one in our science and math. And I would say building these sites requires, I'm sure on your campuses as well, office space on this campus is a hot commodity, and it can get ugly vying for office space. And so it really requires nurturing relationships for a few years with a department before you can get them to share an office with you. So it's really working on building relationships with professors, with heads of departments, a lot of lunches, a lot of going to their classes, doing workshops, decreasing their stigma around mental health. And then it gets to a point where they start referring students to you and you become BFFs, and then they offer you an office or you request an office. Some of the sites have been because there were critical incidents around, like, for example, in the library, there was a student worker in the library who was psychotic, and we did a lot of work with them in supporting this student to the point where they really trusted us. They really wanted more of our support, and that was our in to our site there, which actually, I think 2 years prior, I tried to get a room there, and they said, we can't give up our space. We just don't have it. And then after this incident, they actually asked us to come. So sometimes it's using those critical, those crises on campus as opportunities to create a site. But I really think it is about building bridges and building connections and relationships on campus. I don't know if anyone has any questions or thoughts about that.
So last year, Sue and I joined Erica Weathers from Mount Holyoke and Megan Marks from University of Kentucky, and we talked about how Let's Talk is implemented in our various universities, and really depends on, you know, the setup of the school, the location, lots of different factors. For example, we use a consent form. So every student we see at our Let's Talk, we have them read a brief little blurb, and they sign consent for us to be able to meet with them. At University of Kentucky, however, they don't actually have their students who are seen at Let's Talk sign consent. But our school, we have them sign a consent form prior to meeting with them at Let's Talk.
Yeah. So confidentiality is, you know, of course, a big issue. Consent is a big issue. When we consulted with our campus lawyers and our New Jersey Psychological Association lawyers when we first started the program, what we were told was that our identities and liability as psychologists still hold no matter what we're doing. So whether we are in our offices or in a room on campus, we still are a psychologist or a counselor and are bound by all the limits of confidentiality. So we felt it was important to not have anonymous hours, but have confidential, you know, hours. And we do have consent form to, you know, just a couple sentences. And we do collect identifying information and you know, some information to collect some statistics. And it hasn't been a problem.
We do that as well. I mean, that was one of the things that we, similar process with our attorneys from the very beginning. Where we still have to document what we do. These are some of the things that we went through with Sharon and Wei and Matt early on, because we got this exact same advice.
Yeah, and we have non-client notes in titanium, for those of you who use titanium. So we do non-client notes, we do document each visit, and then if the student becomes a formal client within titanium, we can transfer it to a clinical note. And that's worked out fine. We're at a point now where we do have outreach laptops that we can take with us to the Let's Talk site so that we can log on to Titanium there, and we can go ahead and, you know, the whole point is really decreasing the stages and levels of barriers to care. So if we can schedule them for an intake right there and then, we do that. If we can see them ourselves. We try to do that. If that's not possible, then we try and connect them with someone for an intake who might be more likely to end up seeing them, so there's less transitions where they have to spew out their story over and over again. Sometimes we have a dispo form that we give them with our recommendations. So for some students, it might be that we've called in the session with them and made the appointment at CAPS. For other students where we might not be as concerned, we'll say, you know, feel free to call, here's the number, and give them the instructions. We have a triage system. The first point of contact with CAPS, if you're interested in services, is to schedule a 15 to 20 minute phone triage. However, if you go to a Let's Talk, you can skip that step and you can go straight to an intake, just because that would be just too many steps and too redundant. So they are able to go straight to an intake.
Yeah, that's exactly how our system works as well. I think a lot of places that have telephone triage systems use Let's Talk as kind of in lieu of that triage system. And we see it as a standalone service, but also a way into CAPS if that's what's needed.
Greg, I was wondering, what percentage of the students that you see at Let's Talk actually end up coming to CAPS for an intake?
You know, that varies. It's probably 15 to 20% over the years as we look at it. We really try to see it as a distinct service. And I think, you know, one of the huge benefits is kind of normalizing the universality, the whole kind of cultural outreach. I mean, I think we, in a way, has done a lot of brilliant work here talking to our staff about moving beyond even the language of cultural competence to the language of cultural consciousness and cultural humility. Because, you know, what we found sometimes as staff is it's really easy to get into, well, I have certain expertise with this group, which doesn't necessarily generalize to another group, that you have to develop the kind of consciousness and humility of saying, I always have to think about these things, and there are always going to be gaps in my knowledge. It's not a check I'm able to change the oil in my car kind of thing, competence, that it really requires these broader constructs and heuristics to do the Let's Talk work well, because you're going to see people that are going to be outside of your wheelhouse no matter how much diversity training you've done or how much work you've done around inclusion and social justice. The work itself, I think, keeps you pretty conscious and humble if you're really going to engage with it, day in and day out.
Absolutely, I agree.
We did want to move into maybe some questions that folks had submitted ahead of time, and also just questions for the folks that are attending, especially via web. We'll ask you to submit your questions in the chat box, but one of the questions that was submitted, or a couple of them, so was it hard to get buy-in either from counseling staff or from higher ups to do a Let's Talk program? And then also, what did the timeline look like for the initial startup of your program into seeing students utilizing it and to validate, you know, the staff resources that were dedicated to your Let's Talk program?
I will say that there some of the sites, it was trial and error, where if it didn't work out, what we would do, we would start in the fall semester, and if something wasn't working, we might tweak something for the spring. So we might tweak the time a little bit, or we might tweak the marketing that we were doing and really beef up the marketing a bit more and give it another full try for the spring semester. And then if we still weren't getting the numbers that we needed, then we would move on to another location for the following year. It's always very tricky when we used to have more printed materials that we sent out, you know, versus now a lot of it is online. So I would say giving it a full year, really trying your marketing, really going out there and outreaching, getting the word out is important. Building relationships and continuing to build relationships with potential referral sources, with professors, with administration. As soon as it started to be something that really started thriving, all of the sudden the vice president of the university put it on my evaluation. SUDA is expected to start 2 more Let's Talk sites in the next year. The hardest because
wow.
Things expect of me. So it was the opposite of buy-in. It was now a part of my job description. But guess what we were able to do, Greg? Because of you all and your program, my amazing director, Jacqueline Friedman Lombardo.
Jacqueline's great.
Well, if SUDA is going to have two more Let's Talk sites, we need more staffing.
Nice.
And I would say over the years, one of our part-time psychologists moved to full-time, our part-time referral coordinator moved to full-time, and eventually we were able to hire Jude as a suicide prevention coordinator.
Wow.
And I do, in large part, it's because of Let's Talk. Around the same time, our on-call crises were increased as well. There were critical events at other universities across campus that really was bringing more attention to the need for prevention. So all of these things combined really is why we have Jude here on staff now. So it's really, I think, you know, Let's Talk has really increased our services overall in general.
Yeah, and I would say our experience has been very much the same. I mean, as a director, you know, I've followed the lead of our Let's Talk staff, our community-based service staff. We've definitely used it in a similar way to argue for more staff. You know, the issue has not really been buy-in. I mean, I think there's always some tension if you're a director, a clinical director, to kind of balance the people walking in, which continues to grow exponentially everywhere I'm aware of, you know, with the kind of getting out there. But I mean, I tell people if I was a counseling center of one person, I'd spend some time doing Let's Talk, no matter how busy I was in the center, just because I think it changes the dynamic, it changes the relationship with the center, it changes how people see it. And, you know, all change is founded on relationships. And this is a way to build a relationship with the entire university community. I think it's one of the most effective ways to do that. I've seen some real change.
System within CAPS. Doing Let's Talks is not for everyone. Not everyone would be good at it, you know, and people would really rather quit than do Let's Talk, you know? So
yeah.
It's not for everyone. And I do think it's important that kind of self-motivated who does Let's Talk. You know, we've as a staff worked together for a long time together, and, you know our strengths and weaknesses. And there's some people that just wouldn't do well with rapid fire therapy like that. I mean,
right.
We say it's not therapy, you know, but there are definitely many therapeutic, you know, techniques that we use in that time. And so it's not for everyone. And just like outreach is not for everyone. So I think we have an understanding that some of us are Let's Talkers and some of us aren't. But
yeah.
Gradually it has become a part of our staff meetings, a part of our disposition meetings, a part of our clinical meetings, where, you know, somebody will bring up this person and then the person who saw them at Let's Talk will chime in saying, oh, I know this person, they came from Let's Talk. And it's just kind of become a part of how we talk about each case that comes in. Some people come in through triage, some people come in through Let's Talk, some people just rotate through Let's Talk, and then we have to figure out, okay, how do we want to manage students who, you know, we're all seeing at Let's Talk, and then they become a client here, and they also have a therapist, so now it's tricky because that might be a bit of a too much of our services, so how do we manage this situation and make sure we're all on the same page? So I think it's just become one of our critical services that's just woven into all of our dialogues.
Yeah, I agree. And it's not for everybody. I mean, I think that's been my experience. And, you know, we have a big enough staff where it doesn't have to be for everybody. But, you know, it can be very energizing, I think, for the entire staff. And a lot of staff who may not, you know, really like that kind of work still are energized by having it as a resource and knowing their colleagues are out there in the community and really value it. Because I do think the benefits are pervasive throughout the entire center.
Great, thank you. One other question before we open it up to the other folks that are on this call. How are you all currently tracking data, evaluating or otherwise assessing the success of your Let's Talk program?
We have a Survey Monkey link. We have a 10-item survey because that's the limit for free surveys through Survey Monkey. And we have a system where it's a failed system. Let me just say that before I say it's not working and we're trying to revamp it. So I look forward to hearing what you say, Greg. What we're to do is follow up with the Let's Talks that we've seen that day with an email and a link to the survey. Mm-hmm. And then the response rate is so low that it's really not worth that effort. And some of us, I will say myself, I mean, you know, writing the note is the priority that day. Yeah. I also supervise two postdocs and their notes. So I'm not consistent with getting this email out. Some of us are better at it than others.
I will also say, too, for every individual that we see at Let's Talk, we give them a follow-up recommendations form. On this form, we have, you know, we indicate what we'd like for them to do or some suggestions about things that they do. And on this form is a suggestion for them to go visit us on our website and to fill out this evaluation form for us.
Yeah.
Some of them are not quite as good at it as others, but... But yeah, that's how we track that. We also track the numbers that we see on Titanium too. We identify how many people we see at every Let's Talk site. And Titanium also collects demographic information. Like I think we collect things like race or ethnicity, mm-hmm. gender, class year, mm-hmm. Resident status, EOF status, and international student status.
Yeah, I mean, we try to do some similar things in terms of some QI initiatives around satisfaction related to it. I mean, we point click has the ability to send messages to students, so we've done that to some extent to try to get their feedback. I think oftentimes the numbers are a little challenging. I mean, we still allow for an anonymous option. 98% of folks don't take that. I mean, they give us their name, so we do have contact with them. I mean, we get a download of all students, faculty, and staff to our electronic health record. So, you know, we've used that. You know, satisfaction's often just incredibly high. We've also, just for general satisfaction surveys, we've asked that we do at the counseling center. We've asked if they participated in Let's Talk and then asked some follow-up questions. You know, again, it's mostly been survey, and it's been incredibly positive. And then the word of mouth is always very positive, just to know people can drop in. Our biggest thing is, you know, with students every year, new students come in and they don't know about it. So how do you get that word of mouth? Because I think so many other things we've tried around, you know, emails or electronic communications, it oftentimes misses people. But the word of mouth is what's been most important.
We have Let's Talk brochures that yeah. we give out at classes, at our tabling. We put them all over campus in all departments. I'm still a bit old school and a paper tree person. I know I need to work on that, but I will say that when students come in often for Let's Talk, they're holding the sheet of paper. So someone gave it to them.
Right.
So, you know, so there's still, and I think there was a semester we tried not having them and people asked for them.
Yeah.
Professors asked for them, departments asked for them. So we do also have it. We have a campus-wide, you know, wellness email that goes out from communications periodically. We have it on our website, on our app. Yeah, all kinds of, you know, places. So we try to have it, you know, all over this. We have screens in each building on campus, and there's a Let's Talk screen that flashes. So, you know, any way we can, we get the word out there.
Great, thank you. There's a question from April at Southeastern Oklahoma State. How long are your appointments for a Let's Talk?
So for us, that's determined by, we don't set a time. I mean, if people are waiting, they tend to be briefer. Sometimes if no one's waiting, they'll go longer. We leave that pretty flexible. They're not pre-scheduled.
Greg, what are your slots for each location each day?
They're walk-ins. So, you know, those are on our website. You can go look on our website and see all the different Let's Talk drop-in hours, you know, so like.
Or is it like 90 minutes?
They're usually 2 hours, like 12 to 2 in athletics, 2:30 to 4:30 in the first year experience building, global learning, 2:30 to 4:30. So they're mostly, there's really 2 hour slots. And sometimes we can see 6 or 8 people in those 2 hour slots. which is another reason some people don't, you know, love Let's Talk until their slot gets really popular, and then sometimes they're overwhelmed and need to take a semester off Let's Talk because for those reasons. So, but yeah, they're really, all of them, I'm looking at them now, are all 2-hour blocks, and that's generally what they've been. They give people some time to transition from gaps, a couple hours there, wrap up with notes by the end of the day.
Yeah. Our slots are all 90 minutes. Some of us do have, we keep a half hour cushion at the end of that in case there's a little bit of an overflow. Some of us, that might not be possible, you know, so that does vary a bit. And we try as much as possible, even if someone isn't waiting, to keep it to a 15 to 20 minute short contact and then open the door. I don't know if there's ever any time, at least at my sites, that people aren't waiting, where I can kind of have time to see someone for longer. But we really try and stay in the mindset that this is not a therapy session. And, you know, right, once it goes past that 20 minutes, it shifts. Now, mind you, of course, there's situations where someone, you know, has a lot going on, is very distressed, that of course, is not possible, you know. But almost always there are people waiting, so we have to keep a certain, you know, frame.
That's true for us, too.
Yeah, and so if the person needs more than that, we'll schedule a consult at CAPS, or we're at a point where Monday through Thursday we have 2 sites each day, so people can go to the next site if there isn't enough time, you know, in the earlier one. We found also, like, you know, sometimes I'll go and 3 or 4 people will already be waiting, and so how I'll handle.
Yeah, we have that experience.
Yeah, it's a little stressful for the counselor, right? But sometimes I will see you from 10 to 10:20. I'll see you 10:20. I'll see you at 10:40. Inevitably, somebody will say, well, I have a class. I can't wait. And I will tell you, somebody will always say, oh, I can wait. Why don't you go first? You can go ahead because I'm good. Or if someone has been a returner and come a few times, almost always they'll say, oh, I can wait. You know, once someone has come several times, we usually say more than 3 times, then it's kind of this code that like, you know, we have a talk with them about, it seems like it's been really helpful to you and you would really benefit from talking to me or one of my colleagues on a more ongoing basis. Why don't we schedule something over at CAPS? You know, So that then that returner isn't then taking up the time that we could be seeing a new person, and then we transfer them to a more ongoing type of care.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Great, thanks. April also asked if do you currently or have you thought about using this model to serve online students?
We have not. I think that the whole online issue is a separate issue. I think, you know, the issue where online and technology works is where you have a surplus of providers and a bunch of people who can't get to them, which is not usually the case on a lot of college campuses. It may be. Usually it's, for us, it's kind of reversed. So, you know, we haven't felt that pressure to do it in an online way. We would need more staff to do it.
We don't offer Let's Talk via online. We do have online services. We have things like Tao, but it's not like Let's Talk. It's not an individual kind of one-on-one service, unfortunately. And I don't really see how that something like that would be able to work.
That gives me panic symptoms just thinking about it.
I think it would create a lot of challenges.
Thank you. So Jill asks, how do you control for students who may be utilizing this Let's Talk modality all the time and passively refusing to go to counseling? Do you ever refuse to see them in Let's Talk if they clearly need counseling?
I mean, we've had those conversations. That's why we have a a community-based service outreach team to consult about how to manage those. The therapist usually kind of confronts the person on this, saying, hey, this isn't really a modality that meets your needs and the way to get your needs met or to transition into ongoing therapy. It really doesn't happen that often. I think most people kind of understand it. They know they keep coming back. They've been given the message. It mostly works pretty well. I think therapists can do it in a boundaried way, just like you do any kind of therapeutic intervention in a way that's boundaried by your professional ethics and training.
Yeah.
And if we oftentimes, we have a team meeting, we meet several times throughout the week, and if we come to find that there's a student who's utilizing a number of Let's Talks, what we do is we develop a plan for that individual, and we say, hey, your contact person is going to be this, and we're going to refer you to this. So we try to make sure that we're all on the same page with regard mm-hmm. to how we address that particular individual.
Yeah. If ever I've had someone really repeatedly coming in and then maybe not following through on a referral or something like that, same as what Greg stated, I might schedule actually a CAPS consult with them to have to talk with them about that, it seemed like you really needed more time, so let's schedule this and develop a plan for you. And it clearly shows that there's something in our system that's not meeting their needs. So trying to figure out what that is, it might be an appointment with our referral coordinator and our referral coordinator working with them a bit on a referral off campus. Let's say they utilized already their short-term kind of resources here at CAPS. But what I've found for those repeaters is when I've said, I'm really sorry, but if I see you continuously, I'm not able to meet the needs of all these other students that yeah. are waiting, and kind of state that in a compassionate way. I haven't had a problem with that, but then I don't want to abandon that person either. So also simultaneously working with that person on making sure they are connected to whatever other resources could be helpful to them.
We have a question from Barbara Lewis at Harvard. In starting a Let's Talk program, how did you balance scheduling time in community sites with losing valuable clinical time as the program starts to take off?
Yeah, I think that's always a balance. For us, it's an ongoing conversation with our clinical team, with Wei, who's our outreach person, and our clinical director. So we are always talking about how we balance that. We see this as clinical time. It's time with people directly. So when people are out doing the Let's Talk work, they get fewer intakes of more traditional clinical work. But it's a balance. It's a trade-off. But I think it's still worth it. The positive image you get out in the community. Every counseling center, probably you would hear from about every counseling service, oh, you can't get in. You can't get in fast enough. You can't see people long enough. The Let's Talk program really helps realistically mitigate that narrative. And you may still be limited in how much therapy or medication management you can provide, but everyone's entitled to drop into a Let's Talk site. So it's a part of a scope of care issue as well.
And for us too, it's a great way for our students just to get a sense of what each counselor is like. So not all of us participate in Let's Talk, but about half of us do. So that's one way that students are able to kind of get a sense of the therapist they might choose to want to work with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's Talk has done wonders for us in so many ways on campus. We call the departments that house us, we call them our Let's Talk campus partners, and have developed wonderful relationships with them. They market the Let's Talk just as much as we do. They are key stakeholders in the program and feel a pride associated with that. Also, it's been a way to offer support when critical incidents happen in the news, in the media. I feel like there's one every week, but whenever an email goes out in response to something or for support to a particular community in the aftermath of something, Let's Talk is one of those resources that is offered. And so rather than being reactive when incidents arise, having Let's Talk can be a proactive
support resource on campus that's there and available to particular populations when needed and to all students who may be not only directly but indirectly impacted by situations. So, you know, we use it for many, many things. We don't have to create something when something arises. We already have that in place. And also, I'm very proud to say we have these awards by the Vice President, the Student and Campus Life Awards every year that are chosen, and our Let's Talk staff and campus partners got a teamwork award on campus this year for our Let's Talk program. And so it was just something just very, very sweet to show that this is truly a community effort, and it's not just CAPS, it's not just a particular department, it's all of those staff, faculty, and departments that have come together, whether as referral sources or sharing their office space. And it's truly, I think, the epitome of creating a community of care. And so I just think it's been an invaluable resource on campus, and just invaluable for our relationships and just for destigmatizing CAPS as a whole.
A question from Jill. Do you ever use peer counselors, interns, or practicum students from your own universities for Let's Talk?
We don't. We have a separate program for peer counseling called EARS. It's front of the Dean of Students office. We keep it very separate. I mean, one of the questions that comes up with Let's Talk is, couldn't anybody do it? I mean, couldn't student affairs folks do it? And to some extent, the answer is yes, until you see something that's more problematic. And there's no bright line there. So, you know, we've really said this is something that we want our professional folks to do. We've had to hospitalize people from Let's Talk sites. You just never know when you throw open the doors and put some of these boundaries, you know, you dissolve some of these boundaries intentionally. There can be some risk to that, but we want licensed people out there or people who are trained as mental health professionals.
Yeah, we agree as well. You just don't know what you can get. And just like with on-call, you really need to be able to be responsive to whatever you get and be comfortable with not knowing what that's going to be, you know, just like consultations, you know, at CAPS. And so, you know, one student could be like just stressed or, you know, I don't know if I don't know if I've ever gotten a worried well student at Let's Talk. You know, I feel it's intense stuff. It's intense pathology. It's you know, secondary and tertiary prevention. It can be pretty intense. We have not had our peer, we have mental health ambassadors. We would not have them do Let's Talk. We also do not have our doctoral externs do Let's Talk. We do have our postdocs do Let's Talk. They are supervised by one of us, by me. I go through all of their notes with them. In the beginning, the first month, they shadowed me, and depending on their experience and comfort when they were ready, I then shadowed them, and you know, we kind of did them together. And then when they, then I think I had a supervision hour with them weekly where we would go through, I think that went, go through each of the cases that they had, since each can be so unique. I would say right around early October, mid-October, they're ready to kind of individuate and do it on their own. But, you know, they definitely come to us on an as needed basis, and we feel comfortable with them consulting when needed. And then I, by the next day, read their notes and respond, and, you know, we follow up as needed if you know, something further is needed. But that model has, I think, worked pretty well. It depends on the postdocs. There have been years where it's not a fit for postdocs, but we've decided that it's an important skill, just as important as individual therapy, that they learn how to work in this model.
Great, thank you. So we're going to open it up for questions for the broader group after this next question, but I'm wondering if folks on the line potentially might be interested in responding to this one too. The University of Richmond is wondering, are you all aware of smaller schools
With high counseling center utilization already and fewer staff to cut loose for Let's Talk that are using this Let's Talk model?
I do know Mount Holyoke College uses it. Erica Weathers is the outreach coordinator. I consulted with them a bit when they started it. I used to be the outreach and multicultural coordinator there years ago. And I think, I don't know how many they have at the moment, but I know it started in their international student community. So they're strategically located, you know, based on the need. And they have only 3,000 students. So I think it can be done. My guess is it would be more strategic or you know, geographically located, perhaps, in an intentional way. I don't know in terms of having fewer psychologists and staff, it is tricky. I'm not exactly sure how they handle that, but my guess is just like in our larger institutions, it's quite a balancing act of how to manage that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we try to keep track of all the schools that develop programs. I think there's over 60 at least, comes across our listserv frequently. I know there are some smaller schools that are doing it. I don't have the names off the top of my head, but I mean, like I said, I think if I was a center of one, I would still make time for this because I believe it's incredibly valuable. And I think you're reaching people in some ways you wouldn't otherwise.
So, you know, the students who we schedule them for weekly therapy, they do the intake, they come in for therapy, but they're irregular and you know, have a lot of missed appointments, a lot of lates. And you know, it used to be, and in my training, it was always seen as ambivalence, resistance. They're not ready, and we need to do psychoeducation to get them to conform to the process of therapy and weekly therapy and how it works and how it's supposed to work. And this really is taking that and really reconceptualizing it.
Definitely.
That is not for everyone, you know, and there are, for example, for international students, there are students that, you know, you go to a doctor when you feel sick, and they don't necessarily buy into or conform with this process of psychotherapy that we do. They don't want to think about it on days that they're fine, and they want to compartmentalize, and they want to work on it on a PRN basis when they're having a bad day, which goes against all of our traditional therapy training, but it's really kind of making a statement that we're meeting them where they are, and we are restructuring our services to reach them as they need. And then you might have less fail to show for a point. You know, that might be a student that you don't see at CAPS and might just be a Let's Talk student, you know? So
yeah,
if they miss an appointment, we might say, you know, this might not be for you. Why don't you just utilize Let's Talk?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I agree. It really is just about tweaking the boundaries of what we've been trained for around traditional therapy.
Great, thanks. So if other folks on the call have questions, just a reminder, I can see a lot of folks have self-muted, so make sure if you are asking a question to unmute yourself first. Okay, well, I do see Barbara Lewis also asked, staff at sites are really interested in Let's Talk. Students have expressed interest, but it's not being utilized. Is it advertising that makes a difference? So for them, they set up 20 hours a week and had on average 2 students a week at some of their busiest sites.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you start it, you know, like we've already talked about, it takes a little time, and I would stick with it. You know, it is about investing in that relationship early on and sticking with it. And once students hear about it, I mean, I think it does require, you know, working with communication people, spending some time, you know, as a director, I know, Barbara, you do this. I mean, just getting to know folks and you know, having the people, whether that's the front desk person for us at the, you know, Latino Studies program, whether that's the, you know, advisors in different colleges, you know, once those folks began to develop faith in this and begin to refer students to it, that's when we've seen it take off. I mean, this last year we had 533 students, I think we saw. So it's our largest year ever. And some of that's just, I think it comes with time, but there are some sunk costs in that it's often not efficient. We found this when we've added new sites. It's not efficient right away.
How many sites do you have, Greg?
We have 12. I was just looking at that. Yeah.
Wow.
Right now.
Yeah.
We have 12.
I think the marketing is key. I think we have approximately 20 CAPS mental health ambassadors that are out there getting the word out. And as I stated before, you know, when we go to classrooms, when we go to orientations at our tabling, we're constantly talking about Let's Talk. So I think it really is about getting the word out.
And I find, you know, at my Let's Talk, I've often found that students have heard from Let's Talk from other students who've actually attended Let's Talk. So sometimes the best word of mouth is really the students who've actually attended Let's Talk and them kind of marketing it for us.
Yeah, for sure.
Great. Any other questions from our group? There's a question from Megan Kennedy. Is there a structure to the 15 to 20 minute session? How do you keep it within that time limit? And Megan's from the University of Washington.
Yeah, for us, we don't structure it per se. I mean, I think each of our therapists bring their own skills and their own perspectives. But it really is kind of starting with meeting the student's need of what they, you know, asking what the reason for coming, what they want to address. We keep it pretty unstructured most of the time.
Yeah, it is a true test of time management. It really is.
And
it's really all of those, you know, the clinical skills 101 of how to do therapy out the window, and those reflective responses and those open-ended questions often thrown out the window, you know, and you find a way to rapidly build rapport, rapidly build trust, rapidly assess, and give them some tools. And often you're not fixing, you know, of course, I think I would find I would be a millionaire and have some sort of new modality if like you can fix people in that 15 to 20 minutes, right? It does take short term to a whole other level.
Yeah.
But often, you know, what works is I'll give them something, perhaps to follow up on something, to check in on something, to meet with someone, to do this, to do that, you know, as a next step. So you kind of learn, it really does challenge your clinical skills. And you may not open someone up. It's really, you know, the whole seal, not peel stuff, you know.
Yeah.
It's really, you know, coping skills and helping them. So it's more solution focused. Now,
yep.
If someone.
That's what I was going to say, very much more solution focused.
There's much less of. No, I would say I'm still warm and empathic, but I'm about. But there is more down to business with that. Yeah, yeah. Sometimes I now feel, because I also have a whole caseload of clients, sometimes now the therapy hour is quite long. So it does shift your perspective of things.
Great. So I'm aware of the time, so I think we're going to wrap up here. But thank you, Greg, Seta, and Jude.
You're welcome. Thank you.
It's like,
very good to talk with all of you.
Thank you, everyone else, for being here today and for submitting great questions. The conversation doesn't end here, so we definitely look forward to continuing this through listserv emails, through TA calls with your campus advisors, and through kind of email connection as well. So definitely for all of you all who are listening in today, we look forward to continuing the discussion there. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Great talking
Bye,
to
everyone.
You all.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Have a great day.